Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to Off the Beaten Track podcast. I'm your host, I'm Stu Whiffin. It's another week, therefore it's another episode. Today's episode, I sit down with writer and producer Mark Baxter, and this is a great chat. I got to hear about Mark's work through previous guests, friends of him, whether that be Steve Craddock or Johnny Harris, and so I reached out and basically what come back is the chat that you're about to hear, which is glorious, and there's some wonderful records talked about on this episode. Before we get on with the chat, I just want to say thanks to 76 for producing this podcast. And big thanks to Scroobius Pip and everybody over at the Distraction Pieces Network. If this is your first time listening to Off the Beaten Track, then once you finish listening to my chat with Bax, then again, why not go and check out the episodes with Steve Craddock and with Johnny Harris and have a look, because there's about 150 episodes in the back catalogue now. We also talk about acid jazz, so there's also, you can listen to me interviewing Eddie Piller as well. But yeah, there's a bundle of stuff for you to go and have a rummage around and have a listen. And if that's not enough, I also have a Patreon page. So each week I put up standalone radio shows and video episodes and such. So you can go and get stuck into that and support the podcast as well. And you can find out about all of this at offthebeatentrackpodcast.com. Let's get back to today's episode. Please enjoy Off the Beaten Track podcast with Mark Baxter.
It's Off the Beaten Track podcast on the Distraction Pieces Network. With me, Stu Whiffin.
Right, we're recording. Joining me today via the means of Zoom is writer and producer Mark Baxter. Hello.
Hello, sir. How are you? You good?
Yeah, I'm all right. I'm all right. We've already had a little natter before I press record. We put the world to rights on lockdown and quarantine and stuff. So let's get straight in with some records. Bax, can you tell me the song that you think has the greatest ever intro?
Well, this was almost impossible. I don't know what this question. You know what
it's meant to be, this one.
Yeah. I've been doing last. Year, he's making a documentary on the Style Council for Sky Arts, which is now finished and been delivered, and that'll be on the telly very well October time, I believe. But so I've listened to nothing but Style Council for about a year, and I was a massive fan anyway. But I've sort of rediscovered how good they were. I think in a way a lot of political stuff was above my head when I was younger. I'm going 35 years ago now. It's just crazy, isn't it? And I wasn't really aware. I just loved the tunes and I loved the look of it all and, the sort of, no socks and cappuccinos and that stuff they were doing. So I was really into that stuff. But I'm listening to the songs constantly while we've been putting the film together. And the song that stayed with me is Walls Come Tumbling Down, which is a strident old number. But the opening, which is the Hammond organ and the brass kicks in and then we're off and running. It's just got everything. It's got sort of soul, political soul song, which is, at the time, I just loved the music. And only when you listen back and start, as you get older yourself, you start realising how far ahead Mr. Weller was with his head. I mean, I don't know how he did that when he was, relatively in his mid-20s. But the years with the Jam, which is even, again, there's another story. But it's crazy. Yeah, so that tune really stayed with me. And that intro, every time on the edit, every time the intro started, I would immediately look up. It was just like it was like a carrion call, really, to get you. Yeah. Hang on, here we go. And all the other songs were going, and they were great, and they were like, but they were not. They, after a while, they sort of washed over you. But that one, every time I heard that on the edit, yeah. I heard it a few times. I tell you, I looked up and I was gone. I was into it. I was just completely taken into it. Yeah. And yeah, so it's that one for me.
It's I mean, I know you're very good friends with Paul, and
I am now. Yeah, well, I never say very good. I'm very friends with Paul because I can't believe that I'm doing that, because I was the fan of the Style. Well, Messi Jam fan, really, but I was just at the end of it. The Style Council just blew me away. So yeah, to the fact that I know Paul, to have a cup of tea with Paul or coffee is quite weird for me, and still remains so. But you know, I do see him quite a lot actually, and. And he's an interesting guy. There's no two ways about that.
And of all of his work that he's done, I'm going to level with you here, Bax. The track that you've chose is my favourite thing that Paul Weller's ever done.
Wow.
I mean, much as I could bang on about the Jam all day long, that track, for me, just has got everything. And yeah. it's just so, it just thunders along as well. Yeah, it's got such pace.
Yeah, and it rattles along, yeah.
So you mentioned a sort of political side of that. So would that have come out, would that have been the sort of Red Wedge thing that was going on
85,
then?
85, 86, yeah. I mean, yeah. I was getting into the political thing a little bit, because I was in the print and newspaper industry then as a young man from about 20, and I was a SOGAT 82 member, and it was quite a political time, because obviously Murdoch and Thatcher were starting to dismantle the union. So I was going on, well, when they sacked a lot of people at the Sun in 86 and the Wapping dispute kicked in. And I went on a few marches with that. So I was getting into it anyway, but it was around that time, yeah. So I was waking up a little bit. I wouldn't say what I was doing, but I just obviously that was the time, you know, it was C&D and marches and all that thing was going on, and the music was in the middle of it. But I was still really... My passion has remained all my life, music and clothes.
Yeah.
And as a young man, it always has done. But obviously, other things were coming into that as well. But it's only now, really. I'll be honest, only now, when I listen to it now, and music like that and other stuff that Paul's done. And Mick as well, because Mick's dad was SOGAT, and his brother, they were in the print. I didn't know that at the time, but I've met Mick a few times now, and over there as well. So he had that going on in his own family, so that was all part of it. But, it's just that how they could articulate that at quite a young age. And we was all stumbling over just talking in pubs, really, and it was just, you know, it was crazy. But to put it into a song like that, amazing. So, yeah, it was all Red Wedge and all that stuff, the minor strike.
Yeah.
But he did it in such a subtle way that you only the message is really still there now. I didn't really realise it at the time. Yeah. It's such a clever way of doing it, really. And it's a great track.
Wonderful. Track two, Bax. First song that you remember hearing that had an emotional impact on you.
This is a weird one, this one, because when I think back, it's like, for me, it's the people I was with these records, you know. So much the record itself is the people that I was with at the time. And I've gone with Grooving with Mr. Blow by Mr. Blow.
Oh, wonderful.
It's a great old track. But the reason why I picked it is because when we were in the print, it was on night work, like a late shift. So we finished about 11. And we would on a Friday, we would go to the Locomotion, which is a club that Wendy May ran at the Town and Country Club. I think it would have been around late 80s. I mean, a bit vague with the dates, but... And we would go, Mob Andy, we would go like 10 Andy, because we all finished work at the same time. We might get a quick couple of pints and then go over to the TNC. And it would be, it's basically like a grown-up disco. It was just a load of people diving around to Motown and Northern Soul and a bit of Weller and Jack, whatever it might have been. It was all over the place, really. And it was just good vibes. It was a massive party. Every time I went, it was like a party. And I heard that groove with Mr. Blow. And no idea who it was by. Didn't know what it was. And I heard it as I walked into a club one night, and it took me all night to find out who it was. I think I might have spoken to a couple of DJs or people around the DJ saying, "What is that?" And I've never forgotten that when it came on a couple of times. And we went crackers. We were just going crackers. Obviously, I had a few drinks or whatever. And they were flying around. But it was all good people, all people I worked with. And it was like, we were like, in that game was like a social club, really, at work, because our shift work was quite difficult for people to break into, because you start at 3 p.m, they finish at 11. Most of your mates are out already or whatever.
Yeah.
But we all went out as a group. And that group of people, well, I lost my job in eventually in 96. I'll hang on for a few years after the whopping, but I lost it. I've never found that camaraderie ever again. And I was out with a guy this week having a drink who I used to work with, and he said exactly the same thing. He's like, we had that time when we was young, we was on our teenage, well, no, mid-20s, late 20s. And it was just that, them people, and we all cut on people's 55th birthday, 60th birthday, whatever, and it's just in seconds we're all laughing and joking and taking a piss, basically. But it's just, that's what it is. I just, when I close my eyes and hear that record, I can see these guys' faces and the girls we work with all just laughing at each other and having a great time. So it's that emotional, for me, that's the emotional element of that record, really.
And what is that emotion, Bax?
Well, it's a bit nostalgic. It's a bit of loss because we don't do it anymore. We can't do it anymore. We're all too old and we're all too busy and we're whatever. And that's a shame because when we get together, it's like for a couple of hours, it's just like 30 years hasn't happened. It's like, it's just, you know, what you're doing, who you're with, what you're going. And it's just bubbling out of everybody.
Yeah.
And it's very hard to get everyone together again. Very hard. So it's a little bit of loss there, I think. But also, you realise how lucky you was. I was very, very lucky to walk into that job. Wasn't bad financially. And it gave me, I met some very good people. And they were like brothers as much as work colleagues, really. And they remain so. It's you don't find many people in life like that. You know, you people come and go, and you know, you move on and whatever you're doing. But to find a group of people that you didn't grow up with, they were people you worked with, you bumped into in your late teens and in your early 20s, and to remain friends with them. And it's all done through Facebook and social media. Like, yeah. How you do, everyone keeps an eye on each other. You know what you're doing. As I said earlier, about catching up with people, what you're doing, you're okay, do you need anything, what can I do? And, you know, they're all over the place. They're all, you know, up north, they're abroad, whatever. So I would love to go to back that club one night now in our late 50s and 60s. And we probably last about 5 minutes. But to hear that again would be marvellous. And I've got to know Wendy May a little bit, who was the DJ, because I've been in her company a few times, and she still DJs and she's still got great tunes. And she had a really great party night down there, and it was that was our emotional roller coaster years, I think.
I'll tell you what, Bax, that song has got so much importance to me as well. The club that I've worked at for 30 years, the first time I ever walked in there as a clubber, that record was playing when I walked through the doors.
Wow.
I'd never heard it before, and I walked straight in. And I walked straight up to the DJ and I went, who's this?
Yeah.
And went out and bought it. And I've been asked to go on a radio show next week. And right. And they said, you can pick one record that you think a lot of people might never have heard that you think they're like. And I've picked Groovy and Mr. Blow.
How strange is that?
Like, it's such a tune, mate.
It's borderline sort of cheesy, sort of bubblegummy. But I think if you get in the right company and the right time and the right vibe.
Yeah.
It just takes you over. I listen to it like when I was putting this together.
Yeah.
And I've got it on vinyl and whatever, but I listen to it. I just you're away. You know, you're swept away quite quickly. So I'm glad I'm not on my own.
Yeah. No, I'm with you on that one, mate. 100%. Bax, track 3. The song reminds you of your time at school.
Well, this is going to be me in Peckham. I'm born in 62, so probably mid to late 60s. Can't help myself by the Four Tops, because I heard that over. I can still see myself in a school gymnasium climbing about on ropes or whatever we were doing, singing that over and, well, the chorus over and over and over and over again. And it's insanely catchy, which was obviously what it was meant to be. But I was only a kid. I wasn't particularly coming from my dad was more a telly boy than a mod, if you know what I mean. But he had these records. He was a pub singer, my dad. So he loved music, and he had these singles in the flat, which I've now got. And that was one of them. So I must have heard it indoors, or it was a playground tune, you know, when we sing it. But that song, again, if I hear it, I'm back in Peckham in 19, God knows when it was, 68, whatever, 69. And I've been to Churn come out in around, I think, 65, 66. But I, you know, maybe it took a couple of years to get to the Deep South. But I don't know. But yeah, I can hear that. I can hear that song, and I'm gone again. You know, I'm most of the tunes, well, all my tunes on here that you've asked me to think about are all from a bygone day. Really, they're more because I've been, whether this is the result of the lockdown, I'm not sure, but I've been looking back, and you know, say getting older people and find out where people are doing it, and that has made me look back at old photos and get the old tunes out. I've gone backwards a little bit. I mean, I've gone through a few personal issues with my mum sadly dying this year, so all that's all wrapped up in it, really. But the tunes are just they were life, you know, forming, really. Yeah. I think I've never grown tired of the Four Tops, and I'm now 58. So,
I mean, that's a glorious record, mate.
It's a beautiful record, beautiful single. They made some amazing, amazing singles.
Yeah,
Levi Stubbs, The Voice, is just a, I was a godsend.
Absolutely.
Just amazing tunes, and it just, again, you know, memories of good people and good times, really.
So, if we're talking about good times, then so you enjoyed school?
No, hated it.
What didn't you like about school?
I'm no good being told what to do, and I've learned that later in life more than when I was a kid. But I think it's institutions. I'm not good at being put in institutions. I mean, my poor old mum had a terrible time getting me to school. I mean, I did okay once I was there, but the thought of going to school. In fact, when I was 11, I went to secondary school in Peckham, and within about three weeks, I was excluded because I was not fighting as much, but I was sort of defending myself, as I saw it, against this, or suddenly gone from a little junior school into a big comprehensive in Peckham. And it ain't easy. It's not an easy move when you're 11. I think I was quite a young 11, if you know what I mean, 11, 12. And I just I couldn't get on with it at all. So within 3 weeks, my mum was getting phone calls saying, take the boy out of school because he's in trouble and he's doing this, he's doing that. I didn't go to school for a year. I had a year out, which at that age, 11, 12, is quite...
That's massive.
It's massive, yeah. And my mum was like, you've got to go back. So I ended up going into a tutorial, which is like a for the bad boys. But I wasn't really a bad boy, but I got put in there anyway because that's where the place they could put me. So all the kids in there were quite rough and tough and, you know, trouble merchants, is what I would call them.
How was that then? How was that then?
I did three mornings a week. That's all I could do. And the rest of the time, my old mum, God rest her, made me go to the local library, Campbell Library, and read. And she said, if you're not doing it, and you're not educating yourself at school or this tutorial, you will do it yourself. I will put you in there, you go in there, and I will come and get you 3 or 4 hours later. And to be fair, I read anything. I read sport, drama, the Yuzu. I love the Yuzu. I love the Yuzu. All these different people and fashion, art, books, anything. I was soaking it up. I was quite a curious, I'd say fairly intelligent kid, but it's just the fact I had to do it with a load of faulty other kids in the room when they were throwing things around and causing havoc, and I just couldn't cope with that. I wasn't made for that. I'm not good with groups of people, you know, like that. I'm not really, it's not my thing, really.
Go on, carry on.
No, I was about to say, so I just reacted. I see kids get bullied, I got bullied, and I would lash out. I wouldn't just accept it and take it I mean, sometimes I did, I had no option. It's about 10 of them, you know, what can you do? You're going to get battered. So but I would then finally get caught doing something or taken out of a school class, I've just done something or whatever. It was only 3 weeks. I mean, 3 weeks at secondary school was crazy, but it was obviously going to end up in major tears. So yeah. I wouldn't go. Mum wouldn't send me. So she said, like, he's going to be a year out. So there is obviously back then you had to have some sort of education. But I self-educated really without really realising it.
It's interesting, you know, you said at the beginning of answering that track that, you know, you didn't like, you know, the institution of it. And the amount of people that I've spoke to on this podcast that are, you know, fundamentally, you know, like yourself, self-employed creatives, you know, whether they be writers, musicians, you know, producers, whatever, most of them have that mindset that, you know, they had a thirst for stuff, but not within the constraints of, you know, an institution.
And, exactly. And you're right, because that's what I notice with a lot of people I know. And you speak to them, they had a very similar story. I was all right at junior school, young kid. But even there, I can remember having, you know, lashing out a few times and not really responding. Most kids just go to school and get on with it. I was always questioning everything. What's this for? Why have I got to do that? Yeah. Who are you? What you ta-? I was always doing that without really always articulating that. I would just do it as a, like, pretty, like, sulking or something. I don't know. But only when I went into from a junior school into a secondary school, and there's a lot of Fairs and Herberts in there. Basically, that's what they were. Just, and there was very little aspiration educational wise. You just get them in there, get them through 5 years, and get them out again.
Yeah.
And I felt that. And I felt that as a kid. And when I was 13, I had the chance to go. That's how bad I was. I had a 13 month, even at the secondary school. I had a year out and went back on the second year. I mean, you can imagine that. I was in the Old Kent Road. This is fresh meat. I'm walking. I've had everyone a year under their belt, and I'm walking. Hello, what have we got here? So I was off again. I was all that happened again. I was like, but I was a bit bigger and a bit tougher, and I just got on with it.
Yeah.
But I wasn't enjoying it at all. And then the headmaster, God bless him, said to me, "You're good at art. You're very good at art. Not, you know, English and history and all that, but art is what you are. Why don't you go to? We'll take you out of school and put you in art college at 13. And I still wouldn't do it. I still wouldn't go. I went, No, I don't want to do anything. Like, and I really regret that, because I could have started a lot younger than I did into this game. Really, I didn't come to this very late, because I was always fighting against that, being put into corners and being told what to do. But looking back, my mum was always like, "You're going to regret that." No, she was right, really. But I managed to get there in the end. But it took a long time to do what I'm doing. But he could see that I wasn't cut. If you think about it, 1,000 kids. There's going to be 10 in there that just never going to work. It's never going to work for them. It's never going to work for them. It can't be for everybody, especially competency in the 70s, when it was all experimental anyway. And then throw these kids together and go and get on with it. And you've got 10, 20 of them kids are going to go, "This is never going to work for me. I'm not made for this." And I think I must have been one of them. But on my last day, I did the exams. My last day, I ran out of there. I mean, I'm not joking. I ran out of there, and I ran all the way home, pretty much all the way home. I was like, "That's me done." Finished on a Friday. I was working on a Monday. And I never looked back. I just when I work, it was like a different. I'm like a different person. I had to get out of that school environment. And you're right, creative people. You speak to them, they say, "I hate school. Couldn't get on with it. It was too restrictive. You had to be something that they not been in the army, I suppose." Really,
it's weird though, because also that sometimes comes laced with like a little addendum on that, where they'll go, but then. Which ties in almost to what you just said there. You know, there'll be like an art teacher or someone in you know, an English teacher that a spot, you know, a bit of creativeness in them and go, "Oh yeah, there was this one teacher that got it." Do you know what I mean? And like, and it's generally the art teacher,
Art teacher where they cut nice guys out. But you know what? I was at school for 4 years. I couldn't name you more than 3 kids. That's the truth. That's how bad. I can't name you more than 3 kids. I've never seen anybody from that school. I've never seen anybody from that school. Maybe one or two after when we first left, but just quickly let that go. But teachers-wise, I can name you 3 or 4 teachers, who I think got it, but they were still bound to make you stay there and do what you got to do. They wouldn't. Yeah. It wasn't. There's no way they could do one-on-one lessons, and they might do it now. I don't know, but they couldn't do it then. Well, they weren't going to do it then. I mean, they were just like, "You just got to sit here and suffer it." But occasionally you get a little word in your ear roll going, "Why don't you go and do that over there?" Or what? I mean, and that's what I did. I was sort of, I think by the age of 13, 14, I sort of worked out the toll it was taking on my mum. She was really stroked. My old man was like, "Just get him out of school and get him go to work." You know, he was like, "You know, he's not working." But she was, "No, he's got to get education." She was right. She was definitely aware of that. Yeah. She couldn't read or write herself very well. I mean, it's true. She was born during the war, but she had no schooling. So she was very keen me and my brother both got some education.
Yeah.
And other teachers, 2 or 3 teachers were very similar, but they could see it was a bit of a lost cause, but they would definitely watch out for you. If it got a bit heavy or you got a bit silly or something was going to go off, they would pull you aside and say, "Look, just go over there for the rest of this lesson and we'll go again tomorrow." And that was it. Was really literally that. Just get through the four years, and you know, it was rough and tough. It was not easy. I mean, Old Kent Road, you know, all the schools around here, all fighting and racking every, all the way into work, into school, on the way home to school, lunch times. It's just a tough environment. And a lot of people I speak to, they go, "Aging on the school." Yeah, I survived.
Yeah.
That's it. Really, I mean, no one's got any qualifications. No, I haven't got any. No one's got, no one I know, honestly, no one went to university, no one went to college. They come out of school, went to work. And then I'm talking late 70s, you could find a job. Yeah. Fairly easy, even though there was a lot of unemployment eventually. But like, it would have been anything, you know, working a cardboard box factory. It didn't matter. It was no other aspiration to do too much. Just get a job and then off you go. Get some money in your pocket, off you go.
Well, with that money in your pocket, Bax.
Nice.
What's a tenuous link there, mate? You like that?
Nice.
What was the first record you remember buying?
Blockbuster by The Sweep.
Oh, wonderful.
Great tune.
Yeah.
I remember, we didn't have a record shop in Campbell. I can remember. I bought a newsagent who had these racks you can buy greetings cards on. And he had records in it, put in paper sleeves.
Yeah.
And I must have heard that. I guess in Top the Pops. I mean, they were amazing to look at, that band. And when you look back, you cannot believe they got away with it, but they did. But the tunes are great. They're really, I mean, even now you put them on, they go, that's a great old track. And Blockbuster. And then, bought in a newsagent, which is like, people say, what are you talking about? It was like, it wasn't like, you know, there wasn't, we had no real access to HMV, not that age anyway. Yeah. I mean, I was sort of in 72, 73. Everything was local. I started getting the West End around 13, 14, mainly to avoid going to school, but that's another story.
Newsagents were a thing though, even when I was, you know, I'm a couple of years younger than you, Bax, but even like I remember there being racks in newsagents and it was all ex jukebox singles. You could get all the ex jukebox, and so you'd have to sort of sit tight because I couldn't afford them like when they were in the charts. But like, give it about a month. If I went down there, I knew I could probably get something just as it was on its like on its way out of the charts. I could get it, middle pushed out, you know.
Yeah, the middle's gone. Those middles were part of our life, weren't they? My old man loves them, and never got any of that. Never understood at the time. Now, I've actually got a jukebox. I bought a jukebox. I was given it. Well, I actually got a jukebox as payment for something.
Wow.
And that's full of that. And I went to a warehouse to pick it up, and this guy had a warehouse, and I'm not kidding you, the size of Wembley Stadium. And in there was, as he flicked all the lights on, all the lights come on, for us, he had a million things in there, like jukeboxes, pinball machines, one-armed bandits, the carousel horses. He was a guy at a concession down the south coast. We would do work for him and he wouldn't pay you, but he'd go, "Help yourself with a jukebox." I got a jukebox when I banned it, and I had a huge case of singles, all with the middles. And he had a machine to bang the middle out. He had that machine. He had that.
Really?
You could buy the machine to do that. But I tried to do it a few. I ended up cracking the record. It's quite difficult to do, actually.
Yeah.
But he was amazing, this fella. And,
Paradise strolling around something
like that. Me and my brother both went in and we were walking around for about 5 hours going, "This is just unbelievable." And I actually sometimes think I dreamed of it because I don't know where it was even. I've just been in the van, I've still got the jukebox and the one-armed bandit. I'm going back in the late 80s, we got that.
Yeah.
But then I started working out why it had a hole in the middle. I never, as a kid, didn't get that at all.
Yeah.
And you're like, "Oh, it's a jukebox. Oh, I've got, you know." That song, and again, you know, you say a different world then, you know, the record shops and the weren't really our thing. It was just like getting where you can. And
yeah, yeah, totally.
Again, that tune would have been a great massive tune in the schools, I suppose.
Hello. I've interrupted the podcast again, haven't I? Sorry, it won't take a sec. All I want to say is, the songs that we're talking about in this podcast, if we can't play them, it's just because of the regulations regarding playing licensed music and such. So if you want to hear the songs, just go over to Spotify and search Off The Beat and Track Podcast, and you can listen to all the songs because I've put playlists up for each of these. If you can't find it on there, I'll send links on all the social media accompanying each episode. So you've just got to press that one button and you can go through and you can enjoy all the songs that our guest picks.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Anyway, I'll shut up, get back to the podcast. See you on the other side.
I mean, whilst we talk about records and that, and you know, from younger days, like, growing up, like, was there music on a lot at home?
Yeah. Yeah, my old man was, he sung in pubs and clubs, the old man. Great voice, actually. Biggest regret, I've got no tape of that. We've got no recording of him doing that. He died 20 years ago, so it's a shame. Yeah. But he, I was, you know, like, again, taken out at 11, 12, you know, take him with you, and I'll end up in a pub, club, anywhere, you know, East End, all over the South, and then there'd be geezers in there, all with dodgy names, because trying to hide their identity, and they'll be cute, walk in, put a name down on a bit of sheet of paper, get in the queue, to get two songs, maybe three if he's good, and then get on the stage, and there'd be a piano player, a drummer. It sounds like a dream, man, but I was there at 30, 12, 13. I loved it. I mean, I sitting there with a bag of prawns and a packet of crisps and whatever, trying to nick a pint. And, that was very, very evocative time. And the old man was a good singer. In every Sunday would be, before we went out, some lunchtime, he'd get up early. And I suppose in a way he was rehearsing, but he wouldn't call me that. He listened to like Nat King Cole, Sinatra, Tony Bennett, etc. And then learn a brush up on the lyrics. So I heard a lot of that. My uncles were in the mod thing a little bit. They were all sort of from the fringes of that. So the music was always, any singles we got is like, you know, obviously the classic Small Faces, The Who, and mm-hmm. The Motown. But amongst that would be all the crooners that the old man loved, you know, like singers he really genuinely loved. And I took him to see Sinatra a couple of years before he died. At the Albert Hall, my old man, I've never seen my old man, who was quite a big old, rough old lump, really. And he was just so quiet. He was just watching it like, it was like, I don't know, seeing God for him, I suppose, because he had every Sinatra album, I think, going, and he would just idolise him. And to actually see him in like live in an arena was, he was just, I still remember him being very, very quiet. He was just like soaking it all up and, yeah, so
what a moment! How lovely!
Yeah, lovely. Yeah, and his love of all that has gone into me, and I love all that sort of culture as well. The not only what they were singing, but what they looked like, what they were wearing, and I love all that sort of 50s, 60s thing. We were surrounded by music. You know, my mum was more of a sort of, I suppose, she was like 1950s Bobby Socks up, so Guy Mitchell and. Right, that sort of thing, really.
Yeah.
But she wasn't really a pop kid, really. She wasn't really into it. But my old man just loved the tune. If he heard a good tune, didn't matter who he was by, he'll buy it and try and learn it to then try and get a piano player to play on a Sunday lunchtime. We had no idea what he was talking about most of the time. But it was hilarious, really. And great stories come out of that. Yeah.
Track 5, the song that soundtracked your years clubbing.
Well, unlike most people who went to acid house clubs, I was going to jazz clubs. I had come out into a jazz thing, which would have been on the back of, I when I was on about the jukebox earlier, when we were working down Camden Market in the mid to late 80s, we had our own stall buying and selling bric-a-brac, vintage clothes, etc. And then on a Sunday lunchtime, there'll be Dingwalls with over jazz club run by Charles Peterson and Patrick Falls. And I would spend my little bit of half-hour lunch break getting in there and hearing the tunes. And it would be obscure 1960s, 50s, 60s jazz, but dance tracks, really. I couldn't dance. I would just get out of the way. The guys, they were great. But I would hear great tunes. And I got mixed up. That was that Style Council, Clothing, Duffer's and George lifestyle, which was like every weekend you'd be out Friday. And I, most of my mates, most of my peers would be Old Kent Road, the million pubs down the Old Kent Road after football. And I got fed up with that quite quickly, thinking, yeah, it's great, but you meet the same people, hear the same music, and hear the same tales. And I wanted more. So I joined Ronnie Scott's when I was 23. Didn't know what I was doing again, but went on my own most of the time because none of my mob would go with me. So I would listen to, I saw some great old acts in there, like Chet Baker, and at the end of their careers, really. But I heard them and saw them. And then, so the track I'm going to pick is Moondance by Grady Tate, which is like the Van Morrison track, but it's a jazz version, which is going to really be very niche and obscure, but it's a wonderful version. And I again, in memory of me, well, I say dancing, more like stamping out a small fire, someone called it once. So in a couple of the Fez, which was down Paddington way. Again, you like little underground, and I think it might be underneath an hotel down here, like a little basement room, very low key, but great tunes. And again, the clothes, everyone was in this lifestyle thing, loafers and no socks and a bit of kabichi. And, it was an old school sort of look, but a jazz look, wooden beads on and all that game, all that thing, acid jazz, really. And I can, if I hear that record again, I could just picture all these going to meeting. And again, I met a new circle of people, because I had to go pretty much on my own or with one mate or so. You meet new people, and I still mate with them people now, which is great. Again, they would say, listen to this, check this out, go here, this record shop's got this. And it would be like white labels and, bootlegs and stuff, because this stuff was really hard to find. So, yeah, that would be my, where other people were going out doing the rave thing, I was going in the sort of smaller jazzy world, really.
So when would that have been? Was that around sort of 88 then?
Yeah, late 80s, early 90s. Yeah, there was we would do that, and then we'd be at the Fridge at Brixton. Charles and Patrick Falls would be up there, and that'd be really busy up there on a Saturday night, sort of get there about, 10 o'clock and finish at 3-4, where it was. Again, hearing great music and just a different vibe. It wasn't like, drinking pints and pints of lager and having a tear up at the end of it. It was just, a bit more of an easy vibe and listening to the music and just a different lifestyle. I think that's where I started moving out of my sort of South London world into another world and thinking there's other things I could be doing here. I was losing job, get a job, lose a job, get a job. I thought, I've got to do it myself. I've got to take control of this and do it myself. And I started, went self-employed in 97, 98. And then once I've gone back on the books, but basically I've always been doing it since then. And just started writing and DJing. And because of this life, I was seeing other people doing it, going, well, why can't I do that? But I was 35 at the time, or whatever. Late, nearly 40, thinking it, quite late to start that. But it was just, I could see it was a life I liked. I liked that sort of vibe, and it was less aggy. A lot of people I knew were angry with the life, what it turned out. They got married young, kids young, job wasn't great, housing wasn't great. They were angry, really. Whereas I was sort of didn't do that until later. Waited and just enjoyed myself, or just checked things out, just got into other things, really. And that's what I'm doing now. That's all these years later, I'm doing, books and producing films, but it was never really an aspiration at the time. It just organically evolved into that. And I think that come out of that lifestyle, that late 80s, 90s lifestyle, seeing the possibilities, really, unless you go there, you wouldn't see them.
I think it was such an interesting time, sort of, maybe you say 87 to 92, like the explosion of music in the UK, you saw the evolution of house music, you saw
you know, that whole acid jazz, you know, thing, like, you know, come to the forefront. You know, you had what was going on in Manchester, you know, happening. Yeah. And, you know, and basically you saw hip hop like evolve. There was so much happening, you know, and obviously, you know, rave culture, you know, these huge illegal raves that were going on all around where I lived, like, you know, in Essex, there was every single field had something happening in it.
Yeah, I mean, it all goes in a melting pot, all that. Everything you're mentioning, all them genres go in a melting pot. And then I think in a way you pick your way through that and find out which fits with you or sits nicely with you. And definitely, I think that's what I found. You know, there's certain things I just got into. I think really, again, you know, listening to the records as a kid, my dad, you know, there was a lot of jazz in there, Nat King Cole, but like before he went sort of easy listening, he was a jazz trio. So I heard quite a lot of early stuff like that, and I picked up on it again, really. But it, I mean, we were being exposed to some more radical early 60s soul jazz, really.
Yeah.
And great tunes, but people no one's ever heard of, really. And it's a shame that these guys were never going to go too commercial. But in a way, we didn't care. You know, I've never really been into commercial, massively pop, the pop world, really. It's always been quite niche for me. I quite like them guys and their stories and why they didn't quite make it, but it didn't matter. They carried on anyway. I like that. I mean, I get that.
Yeah.
Obviously, there's a re-evaluation over the years, but you're right, at the time, there were so many things you could explore and dip in, dip out, really. But for me, that won the day, really, the sort of jazzy thing. So, you know, I then went into DJing, so Northern Soul, 60s pop, ska, reggae, bit of blues, all that, but it's all of a certain 20 years era.
Yeah.
And I've never really come out, of it, really.
All right, well, let's take you home, Bax. Favourite song from an artist from your home county?
Well, this is going to be, I don't know, you might know this, you might not, but this is a single called Nobody's Fool by Cold Turkey. Right, now, obviously, I can see you don't know that is.
But I don't know that.
Well, it's basically Ray Davies under a different name. Ray Davies, it's a song that the second series of the TV show Budgie, Adam Faith, which I love, absolutely love, because I saw that in the 80s on Channel 4 reruns. And the song, and I thought it was Adam Faith singing it, but it's not. It's Dave Davies, Ray's brother, singing it, I think. I'm still not too sure. But for some reason, they put it out, and they couldn't put it out as a Kink, so they put it out as a group called Cold Turkey. I'm not sure why. But it's a song about the dark little streets of the alleyways of Soho. I mean, and I was exploring Soho then, and I really identified with the way Budgie was, the character of Budgie was like hand to mouth and making a living like the best he could. And I was doing that. I was, in a way, I had no wages. I was going meeting people, trying to keep it straight. You know, don't get involved with the naughties, just stay straight. And what can I do here? And I just identified with him. I love Adam Faith. He's great in it. And again, the clothes, early 70s, it's a bit glam rocky, but he's got a lot of Alan Hudson sort of feather cut. It's that sort of look, like, you know, it's just coming out of the suede head thing.
Yeah.
Sort of thrown out. But anyway, I loved all that. And even 15 years after they made it, I really got it. And it's back on telly now. It's back on Talking Pictures, and they're showing it again. And they haven't got to this song yet. They're still on the first series, so no one's heard this. But I found this. I found the single years later and bought it from Czech Republic, of all places. You can't find people know about it now, but I was, for years, who is this? What is this? But that song, but it sums up a part of London and an era of London for me. I mean, and Ray Davies wrote Waterloo Sunset and many, many, many other songs. And he is the poet laureate of London, if you want, really, I suppose. Yeah. So I nearly went to Waterloo Sunset, but I thought, no, I'll go niche and just upset everybody.
Well, I've never heard it, so I'm going to I'm looking forward to going and having a listen to that.
I mean, it's a lovely, great lyrics. It's all about the old back streets of London, really, Soho, really, and it's a bit like the dark side of it, but, you know, and then what you can make of that.
Lovely. Well, you can get back, you can put your DJ app back on now for the last track, Vax, and it's a song that many may not know that you would like them to hear.
It's called I Think It Over by Sam Fletcher, which is a Northern Soul, well, they call it bubblegum sort of track. So it's quite, frothy and poppy in from a Northern Soul sort of genre, but it's got fantastic strings on it. I'm a bit of a sucker for strings. I love a bit of strings in a pop song or a soul tune. I love a bit of that. I don't know what that does something to me. I don't know. But anyway, this has got a lovely bit of that. And I heard this for the first time in, I went to see a play called Once Upon a Time in Wigan, which is about the Northern Soul scene. And I went and saw it at the Greenwich Theatre. So, you know, I don't know, 100 people in there. And at the intermission, as I was going to go and get a red wine, this song broke out. I heard this song. And it just stopped me in my tracks. And I what is this? And I went and bought the soundtrack to the play immediately to find this track. And every gig I've ever done, DJ, I played it. It's one of them you've got to discover. But if I have to do top five ever, it's going to be in there. It's just a beautiful track, great vocal performance. I don't know nothing about the guy at all. But I don't care. I don't want to know anything. I just the fact that I come up with this one track is enough for me. It's just a beautiful track. That's it really.
Well, I put together a playlist to accompany this podcast as well online, so people can go and get stuck in to all of the tracks once they've listened to us have our chat. Bax, as we find ourselves coming out of lockdown, hopefully. What's happening? What you got going on? What's coming up?
Well, we've got the Starcastle film. That's done. It's delivered. That's our biggest film to date. Me and a young guy called Lee Cogswell set a company up in 2013, a film company up, just making little documentaries with no budget, really. And then we've gradually made quite a few films now, and they've been picked up now. Sky Arts have got involved, and we've made a film on Peter Blake for them, and also now Starcastle. So that's that. I've got a book just out now. A little children's book, which is raising money for dementia, which is just come out 10 days ago. And the idea is all the money from that goes to dementia charities because they looked after my mum at the end of her life. And I want to put something back to that, which is a nice thing to do. And we've raised nearly $2,500 already, which is amazing. I'm really pleased with that. So that's out now. And then,
where can people get that from? Mark?
If they email me at mono_media@hotmail.com, it's purely from me. I've got no shops, I've got no, not online, it's just, I've got a box of them, five boxes of them in the spare room, and I'm just, me and my wife did it, because she lost her mum about a year ago, so we've had a bit of a year on the mums. So we got together during lockdown, started writing this kid's story about a robin that, everyone's got a robin that comes along in their garden or wherever, and it reminds, someone says, oh, that's Auntie Nelly come back, or whatever it might be. But I found out where I live is quite a diverse culture, a lot of cultures, and there, a lot of people got the same story, you know, whether they're West Indian or, you know, Indian or Turkish, they've got something like that. They've got, the robin coming back is bringing me good luck, or it's, so I use that sort of analogy to write a story. It's a bit cathartic, really, about my mum, really. But I didn't want to just do it as a book and then try and sell it. I wanted to raise some money, and I was at a meeting with a social club at the home, nursing home where my mum was at the end, and they had no money to get the minibus fixed. I mean, that basic as that. So I said to the woman, "Right, look, I'll find that money for you." So that's what I'm doing. But because of COVID, I haven't seen her since, because that was in March. Because of that, I've lost touch, but I've got in touch with the home, and I'm going to put the money to that. We're doing that now, so that's the project. But the next one is Skinhead and Suede book, which is out in March. That's a book on with Omnibus about these. It's basically street style 67 to 73, which covers a lot of these tunes actually. But it's like Skinhead, original Skinheads. It concentrates really on the fashions more than the political. Which they weren't quite as political as in the 80s. It got a bit horrible in the 80s, very horrible. Like, all this stuff. And that's the difficult bit to explain to people. They think, you say skinny, they think, oh, well, they're racist and fascist. Yeah, the guys were quite rough and tough back in the 60s, but it was more about them. They come out of Jamaican culture, really. It was all about the ska and blue beat. They come out of that. They adopted the look.
It's a shame that every time, like I mention skinhead culture, I have to say what you've just said.
You have to quantify it, yeah.
Because it's been tagged by that oi movement, and I mean, where I live now, I'm literally like 5 minutes from Tilbury, and that was
not a nice place for to be around in the 80s with skinhead culture. Then that wasn't good.
I remember three guys. I lived in the state in Peckham, and I remember three guys. It would have must have been late 60s, early 70s, and they and again I've got a memory of these three guys. They're like just like three peacocks walking through the estate, absolutely pin sharp, razor sharp creases, very colourful. I mean, hard enough, as they say, hard enough to roller skate on. You know, they were tough boys. You know? They were really, really tough. And but they looked amazing. And I've never forgotten that look. And then Suede, which come out of that, which people grew their hair a little bit and softened it a little bit, he's got loads of elements of the Ivy League in there. So it's got, I mean, you know, Ivy League sort of clothing. So American, so loafers and, you know, blazers and college ties. And that sounds, I mean, it's very, again, very niche, but you can see the evolution from the yard, the hard skinheads look, which was a bit of a an anti-hippie look, really. Mm. You know, that's really ticked off with all these hippies, and they would say, like, we ain't that, so shave all your hair off. I mean, that's not us. But it's such a radical look at the time. Imagine that in the late 60s, quite radical.
It's very stark. They were
horrible. Some of them were horrible, you know. There's no two ways about it. It was a lot of racism and a lot of trouble at football, and it was horrible. But again, they adopted a look and a fashion that you still see it about. But the original guys, they're really, the origins of that are as Jamaican culture, like Rude Boy. It's basically the Rude Boy culture. So it's that rough and tough thing. And then the Suede thing is a little bit softer. And then that sort of gets a little bit into Boot Boy and glam. So that's the years 67 to 73. That's out, hopefully out in March next year. But we've got a box set that come out with that. We picked out 10 singles with Trojan. We've done it with Trojan.
Oh, amazing.
So, yeah, that was great. But that come out before the book, unfortunately, because of the COVID situation. Sure. We weren't quite ready. So they went with the book's called Sculpture with an A. There's a track called Sculpture. So it's called that. So that's out. I'm writing that with a guy. Well, the main guy on it is a guy called Paul Anderson, Smiler. One of them is Smiler. And he's written it, and I'm sort of researching and just trying to push it over the line with him, really. And it's an absolute joy to do. So that'd be out about in March, really. Yeah.
Bax, it's been an absolute pleasure chatting to you today, mate.
Lovely, mate. Really nice, mate.
And best of luck with all the things. And I'll put a link on the bio when this comes out, so people can go and find the book.
Brilliant, mate. And that'd be like, much appreciated. And look forward to hearing the soundtrack. Yeah, this sounds good.
Lovely. Thanks, mate.
All the best, mate. Thanks, mate. Right. Bye now.
There you have it. What a great chat that was. What a top fella as well, Mark was. Really good to have a good chat about some great records. And any opportunity I get to speak about Groovy Mr. Blow, which is this bizarre sounding record that's just got, I guess it does what it says on the tin, it's got a really good groove to it. Go and check out the playlist over on Spotify now. And as I said at the beginning, why not go and have a look around in the archives of this podcast, because there's 150, 160 episodes that you can go and have a little look and a listen to. And also, as mentioned, there is also a Patreon page where I put up radio shows each week and stuff. You can find out about all of this stuff at offthebeatentrackpodcast.com. I'm back next time. I'll see you soon. Take care. Much love. Bye-bye. I've got an announcement. Save Our Souls Clothing. www.sosclothing.co.uk. Why am I telling you this? Because they're our official sponsor. Yeah, that's right. Go and check them out, because their clothing is off the scale. You're going to love it. So they've decided they want to be our sponsor, which is amazing. And what I have to do is I have to tell you about why they're amazing. So here's a little bit of blurb. So they've only been going a year. And they're based in Southend-on-Sea, just up the road from me. They put the company together based on a love of tattoos and alternative music. And they've worked with some of the greatest artists around the world to produce these items of clothing that are as unique as you lot. All of the designs are printed using biodegradable, sustainable and water-based inks. In addition to that, they only print on garments made by members of Fairwear Foundation. I mean, come on, great clothing and a conscience. Since going live in April last year, they've seen their audience grow massively and are now selling orders all across the world. And they were recognised by Cosmopolitan magazine as one of the best sustainable clothing brands, alongside names such as Stella McCartney. I mean, that's quite a first year, right? So go and check them out, because they've put a lot of love into supporting this podcast and I couldn't be happier. What else they've done is they've given you 15% off. So if you head over to www.sosclothing.co.uk, do a bit of shopping, see what you like, throw it in the basket, and then on the way out, put in the discount code BEAT15, BEAT15, and that'll save you 15% off. Amazing, right? www.sosclothing.co.uk, official sponsors of Off the Beaten Track podcast.
It's Off the Beaten Track podcast on the Distraction Pieces Network. With me, Stu Whiffin.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.